Welcome to Beekeeping Today Podcast, presented by Bee Culture. Beekeeping Today Podcast is your source for beekeeping news, information, and entertainment. I'm Jeff Ott.
And I'm Kim Flatham.
Hey, Jeff and Kim. Today's sponsor is Global Patties. They're a family-operated business that manufactures protein supplement patties for honeybees. It's a good time to think about honeybee nutrition. Feeding your hive's protein supplement patties will ensure that they produce strong and healthy colonies by increasing brood production and overall honey flow. Now is a great time to consider what type of patty is right for your area and your honeybees. Global offers a variety of standard patties as well as custom patties to meet your needs. No matter where you are, Global is ready to serve you out of their manufacturing plants in Airdrie, Alberta, and in Butte, Montana, or from distribution depots across the continent. Visit them today at www.globalpatties.com.
Thanks, Sheree, and hey, thanks everybody for joining us today. You know, each week we get to talk about how much we appreciate our sponsor support. They help make all of this happen and provide us the ability to bring you each episode. With that, thanks to Bee Culture Magazine for continuing their presenting sponsorship of this podcast. Bee Culture has been the magazine for American beekeeping since 1873. Subscribe to Bee Culture today. We also want to thank 2 Million Blossoms as sponsor of this episode. 2 Million Blossoms is a quarterly magazine dedicated to protecting all pollinators. Learn more in our Season 2, Episode 9 podcast with editor Kirsten Trainer and from visiting www.2millionblossoms.com, and that is with a number 2. Also, check out the new 2 Million Blossoms podcast available from her website or from wherever you download and stream your shows. Hey, Kim, we're approaching the end of July. I can't believe we're here already.
Yeah, it's July weather, that's for sure. If it's not hot, it's raining, and often it's both.
I know just not so long ago, I was complaining about 100-degree heat, and today it's not even 70 yet. It's weird.
Oh, not even 70.
Not even 70. Global weirding, I tell you. Global weirding. So how are your bees hanging out?
Well, that's what they're doing.
Are they?
They're hanging out because it's hot. I've got some shade and I've got ventilation and so they're not doing too bad, but, the bigger colonies are, there's a lot of bees on the front door.
Yeah. You and Jim on Honeybee Obscure just did an episode on dealing with hot bees in the summer. That was a good episode.
Yeah, we did. And he and I are having the same problem this year. And not only that, but, not only what are they doing, but how cranky they get sometimes when it's hot.
The bees get cranky or the beekeepers get cranky?
Well, the bees get cranky and the beekeeper gets tired and old and wet.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that defines a beekeeper.
Yep.
Hey, so that's good. Honeybee Obscure is really a great podcast you guys are putting out. Jim also has been doing some video moments. And I encourage our listeners, if you haven't been watching and listening to Honeybee Obscure, get out there and listen to him and check out the occasional video moment that is also associated with each episode.
He does a good job of those, doesn't he?
He really does. They're entertaining. I really enjoy watching them.
He's got a lot of background in doing video. He did that whole series when he was in extension at the Ohio State University. And so he's got the equipment, he's got the experience, he does a good job.
Yeah, really good. I'm glad he's on the team. Hey, Kim, we've received a couple questions in the last couple weeks. One is from Elizabeth Irving, and she wanted to know, you referred to a book about bee behavior from observing the outside of a colony, and what was that?
Yeah, it's a book, the author is H. Storch, S-T-O-R-C-H, mm-hmm. And it's the title is At the Hive Entrance.
At the Hive Entrance.
And it's what you can learn by watching what's going on at the hive entrance. He did a good job. It's really old, but it's still good. I mean, he did a good job and things haven't changed much. Bees still do what bees did then. you can get it at Northern Bee Books, you know, with Jeremy over in the UK. You can go to his webpage. And you can get the book there. And if you can't find it in a library someplace, I really suggest you take a look at it, because there's a lot you can, before you ever take the cut, before you even light your smoker, you can go out and take a look and see what do you suppose is going on there today. And a lot of the stuff that's going on, they can tell you, you can observe and figure out by just watching what's going on at the front door.
Great. Well, we'll have that, you know, Northern Bee Books isn't a sponsor, but for our listeners, we will post a listing, title of that book and the link to Northern Bee Books in the show notes.
Good.
Look for that. She also had a second question about, well, it'd be easier for me just to read it. So let me go ahead and read this and you can give a quick reply. She says, I understand that bees have different jobs at different points in their life. I have a hive full of nectar that needs to be evaporated, and it's a rainy week. The foragers are stuck inside. Do the house bees recruit foragers to do inside work? Or are the bees like, well, we can't get outside, so we'll get into the supers in a very and get them in very good order? And do the bees continue their housework at night? If I go out and press my ear to the wooden boxes, I can hear them talking to themselves no matter what the weather or time of day. So many questions. Being a bee is complicated. So
it sure is. Well, the thing about foragers do inside housework, and for the most part, probably not, because they have graduated past that. Their flight muscles have changed. The pheromones that they respond to have changed. Their behaviors have changed. They're a forager, mm-hmm. and the bees inside that are dehydrating the honey, that are taking care of the queen, that are feeding the baby bees, their glands are equipped to do those things. Or a forager, if a forager got stuck in a hive for a long time suddenly a lot of the house bees disappeared for some reason, like a pesticide poisoning, some of the foragers would revert back and be able to produce wax and be able to produce brood food, those sorts of things. But for a day or two or three, probably they're just kind of hanging out, going, hey, I got the day off. Cool.
And that's why we see the bee beards.
Well, that's one of the reasons. Yeah. If you get a lot of bees and it's warm inside, they're going to go outside and stay out there so that it's easier to keep the inside, so the inside doesn't overheat. Mm-hmm. That's what you don't want to have happen. They're not, you know, it's warm in there and you don't want it to get too warm, because then you start getting problems with the brood.
All right. There you go, Elizabeth. Hope that helps. Hey, Kim, I one of the things having sponsors gives us the privilege of doing is provides transcripts of each episode. So if anybody is hard of hearing or knows beekeepers who would benefit from the information in our podcast but can't listen to them, doesn't enjoy listening to them because it's hard to hear, you can go out to our podcast webpage and look at transcripts and read transcripts. It's a pretty good service, isn't it, Kim?
Yeah, it is. And it's not only for people like me who don't hear so well, but it's good for people that are just hearing this subject for the first time and want to read along, so they make sure they catch every word. And for like people just starting out that don't know a lot of things, you have a record of what was said.
Yeah. I encourage folks, if you use the transcripts or you know beekeepers who do, let us know. It's a valuable service. It's expensive. But we think it's money well spent, and it provides an additional service or avenue of education for all beekeepers.
Yep, it does.
Today we have a professor there from in your part of the country, Dr. Gene Kritsky. I'm looking forward to having him on.
Yeah, I've known him for quite a while. I met him. He's down in Cincinnati. He's a professor and the dean of the Behavioral and Natural Sciences department at Mount St. Joseph University in Cincinnati, and he's written a big handful of books on a variety of topics. I got to know him when he wrote a book called In Search of the Perfect Hive, and he was looking at the history of the hives and where it might be going from where it is today. And we were at quite a few shows together in the vendor area. He's selling his books, and I was selling our books. So That's where I got to know him. But since then, I have found out that he is a specialist in a whole variety of things other than the history of the hive. And I think we're going to explore a bunch of those today.
Yeah. I was doing some reading up on before he came on, and he's kind of like the Indiana Jones of entomologists.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah. Yeah. He does history. He does hive types. He does other insects. He's a real interesting guy, and I think I hope we can draw out as much as we can with him today.
I'm looking forward to it. All right. Well, let's hear from our friends at Strong Microbials and get into our interview with Dr. Gene Kritsky.
Hello, beekeepers. Your honeybees face a lot of challenges out there. Unbalanced food sources from monoculture crops, holding yards, drought, food shortages, antibiotics, pesticides, and pathogens like chalk brood. To overcome these challenges, your bees need the multiple bacteria that are in all nectars, pollens, and the environment. These bacteria aid honeybees' digestion and improve your honeybees' response and resilience to pesticides. Now you can help improve your honey colony health with a quick, easy, and safe-to-use product. Strong Microbials Super DFM Honeybee uses naturally occurring bacteria to restore the healthy gut biome of your honeybees. Check them out today at www.strongmicrobials.com.
And while you're at the Strong Microbials website, make sure you click on The Hive, their regular newsletter full of information and product updates. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Sitting across the virtual Zoom table right now is Dr. and author Gene Kritsky. Welcome to Beekeeping Today show, Gene.
Glad to be here.
It's good to see you again, Gene. It's been too long.
That's for certain, Kim. Congratulations on the ABCXYZ. That's a wonderful piece of work.
Did you notice the blood all over it?
Yes. I also noticed a couple tears, but it was well worth the wait.
Yeah, it was a task and a half, but I'm glad it's done, and thank you.
Well, you have a chapter in that too, don't you, Gene?
I've got 7 entries in there, I believe.
Yeah, I saw one.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I've forgotten already.
That's the quiz for later. I talked about, I think it's Slovenia, modern Egypt, a number of the hives, skeps, yep, things like that.
Okay, yep. Well, yeah, what a great lead in. So we welcome you to the show today, Gene. We're going to talk to you a little bit about your background, and basically we'll talk about the topic of the summer is the cicada, and you're a resident expert of the cicada. You do have a background in Egyptology and ancient Egypt and keeping bees, which would be great. And you know, just coincidentally, we just finished our 5-part series on different hive types other than the Langstroth, and you have a long background in different hive types. So, and you've written about that. So we want to just touch base on that as well, all in the space of this podcast.
Well, Gene, the cicada is clear and loud in a lot of places right now. And you have a new book on it called Periodical Cicadas, the Brood X Edition. And you've got actually several publications on cicadas. Is this year's brood as good as the last one that they had? Is it better, worse, bigger, smaller?
I get that question a lot. It's kind of an interesting question. It varies on where you are and the local history of the trees and what have you, but it's been a textbook emergence. It started here in Southwest Ohio on the, a few places had some numbers come out on the 15th of May at my house. We had them come out on the 17th and it started out really strong, and then the cold temperatures sort of slowed things down a little. But then we had some nice heat, and it's been textbook. Right now, the cicadas are beginning to dwindle. They're on the downhill slide. They've been singing and mating, and the females are laying eggs. And the sound intensity dropped from 2 weeks ago at 90 decibels to today. It was probably about, 68 to 72.
Amazing. And the population, you think, is about right?
The population's pretty good. We have seen some local declines in due to things like people treating their ash trees for the emerald ash borer. That's with the systemic injected insecticide. And I got an email just yesterday from a woman who had had her trees treated yesterday. And after they left, she was watching the cicadas that were on the trees getting liquid out, dropping over the next several hours. After a day or so, they started dropping like crazy. She was a little bummed about that. And so I'm not sure if she's going to keep her trees or not, but at least she felt bad, like it was a good thing, but at least she was conscious about the cicadas.
Well, I know that there can be some damage to fruit tree, well, many kinds of trees if you get a big population, and they can be, what's the word, pestiferous on occasion?
On occasion, especially, they're very mostly dangerous to small saplings, trees that are usually 4 or 5 feet in height or smaller. There was a paper published in the original American Entomologist back in 1869 that was titled, "Out of Evil Cometh Good." and it was all about how orchardists in Illinois and Missouri were noticing a bumper crop in their fruit trees this year. And they couldn't attribute to what they weren't, they didn't know what they'd done that they'd like to do again. And it turned out the year before was a major emergence of two broods of periodical cicadas, brood 19 and brood 10. And the egg laying was intense and a lot of oviposition scars on those trees, but it turned out it acted like a natural pruning. And so the next year, the flower set in particular was larger than they'd seen in the typical years. And so they had a bumper crop in 1869. And so the cicadas were thought to have done something good for a change.
I'll be darned. That's amazing. That. So your book on Brood X it has a lot of things. The thing I got the most information from was the maps. How do you gather that much information on maps, on the maps that you provide?
Well, the maps are, I am a frustrated historian. And if you see anything that runs through all my books, it's a sense of history. And the first record of periodical cicadas goes back to 1634 when they emerged in Plymouth Colony. And that was reported by the second governor of Plymouth Colony, William Bradford. And the first time brood 10, the X is a Roman numeral. But I have to admit, Kim, brood X sounds sexier.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's like the murder hornet.
That's right. So, we've got records going on from that time on. In fact, I wouldn't have been writing about bees or anything if it wasn't for periodical cicadas, because I was originally an anthropology major. I wanted to study human evolution. And I was asking my professor, we got these two skulls, it's a sample of one for each. How do you know they're not just male and female, what have you? And he started talking about morphometrics and these statistical analyses. And I looked at him, I must have looked totally confused, because he said, well, you ought to take an entomology class, because that's where they're doing that now. And this is back in 1972. I was a sophomore. I went to register for classes, and the way they did that in those days, we didn't have the internet and we didn't have the web. We actually went to this giant field house and we collected computer cards and we stood in lines and what have you. And the K's were the last group of all the cohorts to go through registration, and everything was closed. You know? And I walked up to the table of zoology and I said, I need 5 hours. Is anything open? And the woman said, I'm sorry. All I have is entomology in the lab. And that was it. So that meant I took entomology. In the second week of the class, my professor was Frank Young, and he and I have written a book together and several papers together. Started talking about these cicadas. And I, whoa, this is just really awesome. And what hit me was the idea that if you use, we use the scientific method every day. In apiculture, you make observations, you come up with an idea, you test it with whatever your practice is going to do, and then you either reject or accept that and continue building on your knowledge from there. In history, they have a historical method, and you look for primary sources written in the person's own handwriting, secondary sources, transcriptions, tertiary sources where they're, let's say, like newspaper articles. And then you evaluate the source. Is it the original person or is it somebody that's hearsay and what have you? And that's the historical method. And it hit me that if I could use the tools of history to find historical emergences of cicadas, I could not just have one map from one year. I could have maps that encompasses several emergences. And so while in grad school at the University of Illinois, and I worked with Lou Stannard, who was the cicada specialist at Illinois. I never got the opportunity to take a class from Jay Cox. Boy, did I want to, but it just didn't work out. I started to amass a collection of historical records. And by the time I finished my PhD, I had 7,000 records of previous emergences of periodical cicadas that I put into a computer program, and I kind of started seeing patterns. So brood one was a pattern one of one location. Brood two was a different location. Brood three was out west, and so on. And looking at those, like you could look at a map that was all the emergences since 1634 that were known. Or I could look at two emergences and then the next two and the next two and see how patterns developed. And that's what my research on cicadas evolved into. It's basically looking at how the broods relate to each other, how they evolve. And it also took my interest into history, which led to my interest in beekeeping. Although I became a beekeeper through an indirect route, I started as a bee inspector looking for bacterial diseases, working for the state of Indiana. And so I went that route to begin, but the first I put the veil on, and I had that limited peripheral vision. You all know what I mean. And you're smelling the smoke, and the first time you open that hive and you get that smell of a healthy hive, and it's that sweet wax, the honey, and you're trying to be smooth in the way you handle things because you don't want to jar the hives. Meanwhile, the beekeeper is looking at me over his shoulder to see what I'm going to do, to see how fast I got that smoker lit, all the tests you have to do to show you know what you're doing. But I just fell in love with that whole protocol. And the idea that this is a science that essentially we're still using hives that essentially, you know, the guts of it were produced in 1851, theoretically, and then modified about 20 years later and so on. And that just, that the connection to history really got me. And so that's how I got the maps, to answer your first question. But it also led to my reading a book by Ava Crane, Archaeology of Beekeeping. That changed everything for me.
An interesting connection, a very interesting connection. And I have one more cicada question. And is anything that they do going to be bad for beekeepers? It doesn't sound like it, but I don't know. It only happens once every 10 years.
There's never been a reported instance of where cicadas interfered with honeybees. I'm sure possibly some bivouacking swarm somewhere might have, you know, picked the wrong tree and startled a bunch of cicadas. Maybe that might have happened, but no, there doesn't seem to be any adverse effects between honeybees and the cicadas, which is quite beneficial because I'm fond of both of them and I wouldn't want to create a ruckus in the family.
There you go. Well, that's good that they don't get in each other's way. But the beekeeping part of it, which is how I first met you, was when you came out. You've got several books on the history of bees and beekeeping, hives and hive types, The Quest for the Perfect Hive, of course, The Tears of Ray from Egypt. Jeff will have your webpage on the show notes. But one of the things that you mentioned on your webpage is you got locked in an Egyptian tomb.
That is true. That's in part, I think, where the idea that I was the Indiana Jones of cicadas came about. Yeah. Now, I used to live in Egypt. I was the a Fulbright scholar to Egypt in 81 to 82. I was there when Sadat was assassinated. And it might have been 80, 81, but it was because I came back 83. It was 80, 81. I was a Fulbright scholar teaching at Minya University, part of the Camp David Accords that were signed by President Carter and Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin, was that there'd be more Fulbrighters into the provinces. Almost all the American Fulbrighters in Egypt wanted to live in Cairo. And there were a number of universities that were out in the provinces. And one in particular was Minya, about 150 miles south of Cairo. And they requested an entomologist. And I have always had an interest in ancient Egypt. And that I thought, well, this is great. My whole idea was to go there. I would be teaching some classes, but also do some research on insects as a hieroglyphic motif. And that led quickly to the honeybee, because it's probably the most common insect hieroglyph that's out there. But while I was there, the U.S. ambassador to Egypt at the time was Roy Atherton, I think his name was. I'm not sure if that name is correct. But his wife was on the Fulbright Commission, and they were going to take his son on a tour of the antiquities of Egypt. And so they told me that they were coming down with his son, and they would like to invite me to come along. And I thought it would be just like, you know, small band with us. No, here comes this motorcade, a military escort with His Excellency, the ambassador, and his wife. And of course, wherever that we stopped, they all had to post their pictures with the ambassador. And so Reed, his son, who's in his early 20s, you know, I said, hey, let's go look at the antiquities. I'd been to these sites many times by this time. And we were at Tuna El Gebel, which is an underground necropolis where they found hundreds of mummified ibis birds and baboons. It was a necropolis dedicated to the god Thoth, which is the ibis-headed bird man that also invented hieroglyphs and the record keeper for the afterlife and so on. And so we were in there. Well, of course, there's pictures going on in front of all the major sites in the necropolis. And I said to Reed, I said, let's go back. There's a sarcophagus back about 40 yards and down a shaft. And so we off back we go. While we're in there, a sandstorm, a Khamsin, blew up. And so we were for about 25 minutes. And there were two guards with us as well. I don't know why we needed guards. We weren't going anywhere. And as we come up, everybody's gone. And the door is locked. And the two guards are banging on the door going, Muftah, Muftah, which is key in Arabic. And I look at Reed and you look out. It wasn't like a sealed tomb that you're going to suffocate in an hour or so. You could see a gaping hole and you could look out in the door, look out, and you couldn't see 2 feet. The sandstorm was so thick. So being in the necropolis was probably one of the safest places to be. So I said to Reed, let's go down that shaft. I've never explored that one before. Meanwhile, the guards are banging on the door. And we went down this one side shaft and a corridor, and we found a coffin for an ibis bird and a crocodile skull, mummy linen all over the place. Of course, we couldn't keep any of that, obviously. But it was just neat to realize that here, how many people have the opportunity to be locked in an Egyptian tomb and have the opportunity to go poking around? And of course, they finally, after about 45 minutes to an hour, somewhere there, they come in and lock the door, and they had nice wet towels, not for me, but for the ambassador's son. They pushed me out of the way, wrapped him up in a wet towel, and off they went, and I sort of stumble on behind him.
I think the question is how many have had an opportunity to be locked into a necropolis like that and then walk out?
That's probably true.
A lot of people that go in and never come out.
But it was one of those things that I'll never forget.
Oh, definitely.
BetterBee is pleased to sponsor today's episode of Beekeeping Today podcast. For over 40 years, BetterBee has supplied beekeepers across the country with the tools, equipment, and knowledge needed to succeed. Because many BetterBee employees are beekeepers themselves, they understand your needs and challenges and are better prepared to answer your beekeeping questions. From their colorful catalog to their support of beekeeper educational activities, including this podcast, BetterBee truly lives up to their tagline of beekeepers serving beekeepers. See for yourself at betterbee.com.
That ties, of course, right into the books that you've produced on the history. And The Tears of Ray, as I mentioned, was one of them. Is that when and where you got that information?
A good part of it. I was there for about 10 and a half months and visited 94 archaeological sites. And of course, I was taking notes constantly about anything that had to do with any insects. But I've since taken 4 student groups and friends of the museum back on tours of Egypt. So I've been back 4 times in the last, 4 times probably in the last 15 years I've been back. And I'm making plans to return again because they always find more stuff. There's been a tomb found at Saqqara of a overseer of the beekeepers. I'm trying to get permission to get into, those 4 trips allowed me to visit places I couldn't get to when I was living there, and also to return to places that I wanted to see with the digital camera, that was very helpful in getting the illustrations. You'll notice in the Tears of Ray, I think almost probably 90% of the photographs and pictures I've taken. Either there or in museums around the world.
Well, just briefly, can you outline the how beekeeping was working in Egypt at that time? I mean, how did they keep bees and how big did the operations get? That sort of thing.
Certainly, the neat thing about beekeeping in ancient Egypt is it was a government-run occupation. It We've found evidence in the literature from tombs of the Rekmere, which is the vizier, essentially the prime minister, receiving honey in tribute from all the provinces and surrounding kingdoms. Honey being brought to the pharaoh. We also see records of individuals. So here in Ohio, we have at the Cleveland Art Museum a false door of an Ikara, who was the overseer of the bees in the provincial areas. And so here's his false door, and there's the part of the hieroglyph that talks of his higher rank overseeing beekeepers. And we also have found a small scarab that talks about a chief beekeeper. There are letters in Greek during the Ptolemy times where people the beekeepers had lent their donkeys to someone else to move some material. They needed them back to move their hives. And so they wrote this very kind letter. If you're done with them, we'd like our donkeys back because you have to move the hives to the next location and what have you. As well as letters from overseer saying the beekeepers in this particular area are not pulling their weight. The yields have not been as good as they should have been. And so they were looking at taking some kind of action. So very organized. And I find that just amazing because, and what that revealed to me, you think of ancient Egypt, you think of the pyramids and the Sphinx and King Tut's tomb. That's not what the secret of Egypt is about. The secret of Egypt is to not just to build the pyramid, but to organize people to build the pyramid. That civil structure where you can bring in 20,000 people, house them, feed them, care for their wounds and the injuries and what have you, and over 20 years, build a pyramid. That's impressive. The pyramid's just the results of what they did. But, you know, you look at American politics today, what could we do if we had that kind of cooperation? I don't know.
Amazing.
Well, before we leave the Egyptians, and how were they keeping bees? Were they in the clay tubes? Were they, what kind of hive were they using back then?
We have the beehive that the ancient Egyptians kept. We've got, and again, I define beekeeping as the intentional provision of an artificial cavity within which bees, the queen, will produce comb. The queen lays her eggs, and they produce the next generation and produce honey. It's that's the difference between beekeeping and honey hunting, which is just going off and robbing bees. We have at 2450 BCE a wonderful relief at the Sun Temple of Nesere Ani, a 5th dynasty pharaoh. And the scene that's in here, and the original is at the Neues Museum in Berlin. The scene shows all these activities that take place at different times of the year. And in the fall of the year, they had the scene where there's a beekeeper next to this wall of hives, tubular hives, as you mentioned, Jeff, and there's still, these horizontal hives are still used today. There are about 7,000 still in existence in Egypt proper. There used to be millions about 25 years ago. So, but it's down quite a bit. That we don't know what the beekeeper is doing because it's destroyed. There's some damage where he's right up next to the hives, but it looks like he's got a container, and it's the hieroglyph at the top says to slacken or to make a slight noise. And some of the traditional Egyptian beekeepers actually call the queen, can hear the piping, and that tells them, oh, there's more than one queen in here. And they'll go in there and do what they call, essentially what they're doing is artificial swarming. They're going to go in there and they'll have several queens in one of these hives, take the queen out and some comb from other hives and actually stuff more tubes and get them going again by manipulating the queen. I find that just amazing because we don't do things like that anymore. But they were doing that 4,400 years ago. The next scene that they have there is individuals pouring what looks like pouring honey. And it one of the vessels is, it looks like it's a pot, but there's a spout at the bottom. And that is probably why, how they got rid of most of some of the wax for certain. It's almost like a gravy, a fat separator for gravy production where the spout's at the bottom. You let, I did this. I took some comb honey. I crushed it, put it in a container, just set it in the hot sun. And then about 45 minutes later, there was a whole layer of wax at the top and the honey at the bottom. You could decant the honey out from below it. So that's a process called experimental archaeology, where you try to test old techniques. And then, of course, to get you still had this sort of sticky, waxy mass at the top. And the Egyptians probably did the same that they did in ancient Greece, and that's put it in water, bring it to a boil, and let it cool slowly, and all the wax just collected at the top. very nice and white. I redid that as well, and that works as well. The next scene is terribly damaged, and it just says to squeeze, and that's probably further talking or showing about how they get rid of separate the wax from honey. And then the last scene is storing honey, and it shows vessels with the all being wrapped up and what have you. And that's one of four major scenes of beekeeping in ancient Egypt. But it tells us a couple things. One, the first hives were horizontal. They are these tubes, not dissimilar to the hives that were found by my good friend Ami Mazar at Jerusalem Hebrew University in Jerusalem when he found those hives that date to about 875 BCE, a few years back. And they had, I think, close to about 35, 40 hives in this one bank photographs that he showed me at one time that were used primarily, I think, for wax production, because it looked like they were nearby the copper mine where they were doing copper melting and for lost wax casting. And so that may have been what the major force there. But of course, honey was a major commodity in ancient Egypt. They didn't have money. They didn't carry around coins. They had an idea of value of worth, and it was called the deben. And it was the amount, the value of a vessel made from a piece of copper. They didn't carry the copper around, but there was a general agreement. Okay, a laborer would work for a bag of grain. And if his overseer didn't have the grain, he'd be given some beer. If he didn't have beer, he'd be given bread. If he didn't get bread, they could give money. And they knew the equivalent value of each one, so there no one felt cheated. You got honey, maybe you didn't need honey, but you could go and trade it down the way. So it was like this currency, and which we would find very strange, I think, in this country. But it was something that made the society very close knit. When I lived in Egypt, they didn't have supermarkets. I've been back, as I said several times, they have them now, beautiful supermarkets. But where I was living in Minya, I'd walk into the marketplace, and there was a woman that sold eggs. There was somebody that sold fruit, somebody sold vegetables. I bought my meat at a third place. It was very similar in that I had to talk to many people to get my meal for the day. And it reinforced that connection of community. We go to the grocery store, we might say some pleasantries to the checkout attendant, but that might be it.
Yeah. So you said the 30 or 40 colonies, you said, is that any sense of the size of the apiary, since it was a government-run industry?
Actually, some of the apiaries probably had hundreds of beehives. These things were hollow clay tubes. If they're made like they make them now, they took mud and straw, laid it out flat, and then they rolled it around a bundle of sticks that would be a certain size, let it dry in the sun, and they would actually stack these like cordwood and make walls of these. The biggest one I saw had over 400 hives in it.
Wow.
And they were stamped with a stamping system that told the beekeeper, oh, this was provided with wax at this season and what have you. It's interesting when as I point out in the question, Perfect Hive, the oldest hive is still being used. And that's the horizontal hive. We still have being used in parts of Egypt, but it's also being used in Azerbaijan and Iran. And so we find them in the Sudan. We find them horizontal hives hanging from tree in Tanzania. That is the longest serving hive and hive design that's still with us.
Wow. Well, they definitely didn't have any concerns about drift if they had a wall of hives like that.
Apparently like not. The bees, I figured out one of the cliches I use is, we sometimes don't let bees be bees.
Yeah.
They'll figure it out if they're in the wrong place.
Yep. What you just brought up conjures up this. Every time somebody talks about honey, they talk about how long it lasts and it doesn't spoil. And they've found honey in tombs in Egypt thousands of years old, and it's still good. Is that right?
Well, I've only seen one sample of honey from a tomb, and it looked like tar. it wasn't something that I would want to necessarily to consume. But we do find a number of examples. So, for example, a lot of tombs will actually have food provided for the deceased, and in some cases, that food is coated in honey. If it's like a dried duck or what have you, okay. We also know that they use honey as a medicinal of over 900 pharma pharmaceutical concoctions I read about, half of them had honey as part of the ingredients.
Wow. Okay.
So that's kind of interesting. A few had beeswax. Most of the time, I think a lot of the times they I think the honey was to make it more palatable for people to take, but they used for burns and cuts. And the ancient Egyptians were thought to have the finest physicians in the ancient world. In fact, when Persia came in and conquered Egypt, a lot of the physicians were taken back to Persia.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, so when you hear that the next time from somebody who's talking about honey, you can kind of believe it. It's probably pretty close to being true then. That's interesting. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, then the quest for the perfect hive. And that was the first book of yours that I ran into back then. And so what is the perfect hive?
The one thing I don't want to give away the ending, but I think it's been out long enough that the ending is out there. One of the things that I've always admired about beekeepers, if you look at the history, and I know both of you are this way, I'm sure, is that we're tinkerers. We're always trying to improve it. We're never satisfied. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. I look at the frame wars of the beginning of the previous century, where you had the deep frames and the small frames, and if it wasn't for some change in weather, we could have had a very different hive than we have now. You know, the question is, do we actually have it? Would the perfect hive allow it would be so inviting to hive beetles? Would the perfect hive be something that would that would not be ideally suited for the bees? I mean, think about the theory behind skeps. Round tree trunks are round. It allows for, you know, it can be depending on how it's constructed, can be relatively cool. It could be it stands can withstand some of the elements. You may have to replace it every 2 or 3 years, but in today's money, a typical skep would cost about $20. We can't buy a hive for $20.
No, you can't.
The other thing I know about beekeepers is we're pretty frugal. And so, you know, if you were able to, you know, learn, if you knew how to drive your bees, and most people did by the time they stopped using the brimstone and the pit, the flaming pit, they would very easily take a pail, set the full skep upside down in the pail with two pieces of wood with nails at each end. They'd sort of brace another empty skep on the side up on top, and they start banging the daylights out of the side of the pail. And the bees just sort of ran out of there and up into the empty hive. They took that, put back on the step, and they were done. And it was a small enough space that they could. In my experience, I put in some. I actually used a skep for a couple of years. I have put in three pieces of comb and as a guide at the top. And we know from Edmund Southern, who was the beekeeper during who wrote the first book on English beekeeping in 1594. So he's talking about skeps. Put dowels, just little pieces of wood that it would hold this comb at the top. And you put bees in there and see what they do. A week later, they had not only extended those three, but added three more. And within 30 days, they had filled the whole thing. And it just, yeah. And I often wonder, why is it that it took people so long to figure out the bee space? The bees had it figured out pretty well. I went expecting that I had to pry it off my bottom board. No, it just lifts off because the bees stopped on their own.
They had it figured out.
So, in answer to your question, I think we're still looking. And I think when beekeeping, because first of all, conditions are changing constantly. The whole industry is changing constantly. The hive that the fundamental hive, if you look at some of the catalogs from 1920, if you saw, I've seen people's beehives look just like those. You know, we've got the genome of the honeybee. We got space age bees living in pre-depression era hives. And so the question I'm wondering, is that really the best hive? Yeah. And so my hope is the challenge our colleagues to keep thinking out of the box. And more and more people are trying things like the flow hive. They're trying the Warre hive. They're trying bee house from England, that big plastic thing. It's kind of neat to see that happening.
And we explored some of those on that show that we did with those shows that we did of different kinds of hives. So yes, people are still looking. I think I agree. I don't think they're there yet. Tom Seeley will tell you that hollow trunk of a tree is the perfect hive, and I think he may be pretty close there, but they're a little difficult to manage.
Yeah, I find that a breath of fresh air when Tom came out with talking about Darwinian beekeeping.
Yes,
because we've done every. If you look at that list, how did the bees evolve in their natural cavities? And we've done everything we can to do it just the opposite, and then we wonder why we're having issues.
Yeah, that's pretty clear. That's pretty clear. You've also done something on dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see with your bent towards history why you would be interested in dinosaurs. They're no longer here, I don't think.
Birds.
No, they're
descendants. Yeah. Why the interest in dinosaurs?
Well, again, it's almost, I hate to be autobiographical, but when I was 7 years old, we bought those little boxes, and this may have happened with Kim. You and I are about the same age. That held six little mini Fritos corn chips bags. They were lunch size Fritos bags. And in 61, 62, and 63, they gave out a little dinosaur one. And I remember the first one. I still have this. You know, beekeepers, like historians, keep a lot of things. And I showed it to my mom, and I said, "What is this?" And she said, "That's a dinosaur." I said, "What is that?" And she said, "Look it up."
Good mom.
So I went to the Google of 1962, the World Book Encyclopedia, and looked it up, and it was fascinating. Just like all little kids, just got really immersed into dinosaurs. And I teach an online class on dinosaur biology, and the book I had been using went out of print, and at a moment of weakness and a couple single malt scotches, I decided I can write a book that would really serve my, because the first book's your hardest. And Kim, you know, this is true. The first book's the hardest.
Yes. But
once you've done one, you think you can do them all. And they get easier over time. And then you run into things like the ABCs and you wonder, why did I do this? I thought, yeah, I can do this. And so I wrote this book called The Dinosaur Primer, which is a sort of a fundamental book to let people understand the basics about dinosaur classification, biology, and so on. And that's one of the texts that we use in my course.
Insect mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two words I don't think I would have ever put together in a sentence until I read about that.
Oh, yeah. Insect mythology has been a longstanding interest of mine. Mostly it has to do with its cultural entomology. And myths tell our history. They tell the stories of our beliefs through time. The book I wrote is co-authored by my friend, good friend, Ron Cherry. Used to teach, I think he's retired or close to retirement now, at the University of Florida. He and I were in grad school together at Illinois. And we both had this love of mythology. And so, I just started noticing insects everywhere. My wife Jessie is a jeweler, a silversmith. She has a lot of ancient amulets in her designs, but also a lot of bee stuff. She's done things like skep hives and the honeybee hieroglyph and things like that. But going to art museums with her and her background in art history, I was getting really amazed and fascinated. And then we started looking at it. Insects and bees are almost everywhere. You go to any art museum. I've actually put together a list. I had to send this to Bee Culture. I've had the Beekeeper's Guide to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it's basically
that would be fun.
You're going to New York, and your kids or your wife wants to see the Metropolitan Museum of Art. You may or may not have the same interest, but if you knew where to look for the bee stuff, you'll see a lot more and really get into it way, way more. And, I remember the last time I was at the Met, and a lot of this is ancient Egyptian stuff. They've got a whole collection of things like wax figurines, beeswax stuff and what have you. But I remember going up to the second floor, and all of a sudden here's somebody, it's called the beekeeper, and some guy is sitting on a stool with a big long pipe, and he's looking at his skep. And it was a painting that was on a special exhibit. I didn't expect it to be there. Or when I went to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts the last time, they had a Wyeth exhibit. And one of the paintings was of an old German flat-topped skep with his dog next to it. And of course, the painting was so well done, you could actually decipher how it was assembled. It gave me a lot of insight into how those flat top hives with the spike on the top were made until I had a chance to actually see some more of them in, when I was in Paris.
Amazing.
Very good.
Gene, this has been wonderful and amazing. And we've talked about cicadas and dinosaurs and ancient insects and lots more stuff. I'm so glad you were able to be with us today. And I don't want to wait 10 years to talk to you again. How's that?
That sounds, I'd enjoy coming back again. There's a lot of neat stuff happening out here that I'm working on, and it'd be fun to talk about.
Okay. All right. Well, Jeff, have we missed anything?
I don't think so, Gene. Anything you want to say in closing? We will have all your contact information and a list of books and everything on our website and in the show notes.
Sure. Yeah, it's really not pertinent at all, but I'll just mention this in passing, not so much that the audience wants it, but one of the things I've done recently is I created an app called Cicada Safari. And it's an app where people can go out and go on their own cicada safari, and they see a cicada, they take a picture, and they submit it to our through the app to our website. And that picture is examined by my colleagues and I, who verify that every picture we get is of a periodical cicada. And I'm happy to tell you that right now we have received 194,000 downloads and 564,000 photographs.
Oh my
over gosh. A half a million photographs just this year. But what's more exciting is we've already looked at all of them and checked them out.
We kept up with them.
And that's all been in the last 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's
so. So, Jeff, we got to get how to get that app on the webpage.
We'll have that in our show notes and then on the website.
All right.
Yeah, it'll probably by the time this airs, the cicadas may be done, but there'll be more coming out in 2024 and 2025.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Explore. Right.
Gene, again, thank you for your time and all of this. I'm just gonna have to sit down and digest it for a week or two. So.
Oh, but it's been fun.
All yes, right. It has.
Thank you. We look forward to having you back.
Thank you. You too. You'll stay healthy and hope the bees are doing well for you.
You bet.
I will say that the day before I went out mapping cicadas, I had to stop at my research hive and I installed a new package a couple of weeks earlier, and I had to see how they were doing. So it's I've been mixing beekeeping in with my cicadas quite a bit.
Well, that's good. That's good. Thanks again, Gene.
Oh, all thank right. you. Appreciate it. Have a Take good day.
Care. Bye-bye. Hey, I was really happy to have Gene on the show. You know, we should have had him at the beginning of our Hive Types series. What a wealth of information.
That'd have been a good idea. Yep. Yeah. That'd have been a good idea. But this was pretty amazing. He's got his fingers in an amazing number of pots he's got going on. I was just fascinated listening to him. I've known him for quite a few years since he came out with his In Search of the Perfect Hive book is when I got to know him. But I didn't know anything about his interest in cicadas then. I knew a little bit about his work in Egypt and some of that. But it was good to have him here today. I hope people enjoy it.
Well, you wouldn't have known about his work in cicadas unless you hit him on that 17th year somewhere along the line.
Yep. Well, he was. I was particularly interested in his work with the mythology of entomology, insects, and how they tell the culture. That I had never thought of that insect mythology. Two words, like I said, two words that I would have never put in the same sentence.
Yeah, really,
same sentence.
Mythology. You hear of unicorns and. and flying horses or whatever, but it's never the insect. So that's interesting. And my ears definitely perked up when he talked about going back to Egypt and doing archaeological travels and exploration of beekeeping in Egypt, ancient Egypt. And I was saying, boy, that would be fun to go to.
Yeah, I'd like to just ride around with him for a while. I think that would be fun.
Maybe we can get the podcast to fly us out to Egypt with him and report from the ground.
Yeah, there's a good chance that's not going to happen. Okay.
A definite chance that won't happen.
But, you know, the thing, the age-old question, the honey they found in an ancient pyramid in Egypt after thousands of years was still honey. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's happened several times. So I guess when people are talking about honey talking about honey lasting forever, they're pretty close to right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really interesting. Hear it directly.
I think we're done here. Jeff, it's been a good day.
It is. Well, that wraps up this episode. It's been a fun one. Before we go, I want to encourage our listeners to rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download and stream the show. Your vote helps other beekeepers find us quicker. Even better, write a review and let other beekeepers looking for a new podcast know what you like. You can get there directly from our website by clicking on reviews along the top of any webpage. As always, we thank Bee Culture, the magazine for American beekeeping, for their continued support of the Beekeeping Today podcast. We want to thank our regular episode sponsor, Global Patties. Check them out at www.globalpatties.com. We also want to thank Strong Microbials for their support of the podcast. Check out their full probiotic line at www.strongmicrobials.com. We want to thank Better Bee for joining us as a supporter. Check out all their great beekeeping supplies at www.betterbee.com. And finally, and most importantly, we want to thank you, the Beekeeping Today podcast listener, for joining us on this show. Feel free to send us questions and comments at questions@beekeepingtodaypodcast. We'd love to hear from you. Anything else, Kim?
I think that about wraps it up, Jeff.
It's been a good show. I feel like I should go watch Indiana Jones and with a different perspective.
There you go. Okay.
All right. Take care. Thanks, everybody.